everyone. Welcome to another edition of Soulful, the podcast that reveals everything you've ever wanted to know about sneakers. Hosted by myself, Kish Cash, and my good man, the man at arms, the man with the pen, the man with the keyboard at hand, Jason Coles. How you doing, bro?
I'm doing good, Kish. How's it going? You well?
Yeah, man. Yeah. I have to say, I'm pretty excited about today's guest, and that's probably channeling, you know, through my exuberance, you know. People are going, what's he so excited about? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you're right to be excited, Kish, because, yeah. I mean, we've had some heavy hitters on this show.
We have.
From the sneaker business and sneaker culture. But I think today, our guest might just top that, mightn't he?
Well, I mean, considering he created one of the best and biggest sportswear brands in the world.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're even encapsulated everything that this man has achieved in his life and how he has permeated through and influenced, you know, modern day culture. But yeah, I think we're on a pretty good one.
Exactly. Because our guest today is Mr. Joe Foster, none other than the co-founder and former president of Reebok, which is, a pretty special thing to be. So Joe and his brother Jeff, you know, they started this company all the way back in 1958 in Bolton. And, one of those incredible success stories after parting ways with their father and uncle, you know, 30 years later, they're running a $1 billion company and the number one sports brand in the world. So, you know, we are privileged to have Joe on today. And joining us all the way from his home in France, Mr. Joe Foster.
Joe, brilliant to meet you, actually, you know, not quite in person, but we know each other virtually, I do believe, and I bought your book.
Thank you.
You're from a long line of shoemakers, and I think you must be around, what, the third or fourth generation in your family? Do you know what I mean? How did shoemaking, you know, first come to be a way of life for the Fosters? You know, how did it sort of manifest? Was there a bolt of inspiration? You go, well, we see some shoes over there. I think we can make them. Yes, let's do it. Or was it something a little bit more organic than that?
Well, I think you've got to go back a long way. We've got to go back initially to my grandfather of 1895. 1895, he made his first pair of spiked track shoes.
Mm-hmm. Was he athletically inclined? Is that why he did that?
Yeah, he was part of the local club. I think it was a Bolton Primrose Harriers. He was a member. But of course, we then have to step back a bit further, because he was a cobbler, but his father was a confectioner. He didn't want to be a confectioner, so he went back to his grandfather. And his grandfather was a cobbler in Nottingham, and he used to visit his grandfather. Right. And of course, as a cobbler, repairing shoes, he also repaired sports shoes, in particular cricket boots. And we can only assume that granddad said to his granddad, why have they got spikes in the bottom of these cricket boots? Right. And the obvious answer would be, it gives them grip. When they ball in batting or in the field, they want grip. Oh, it must have been a nice light bulb moment for grandfather. So he obviously went back and thought, we're running on cinder tracks, sometimes on grass. If I put some spikes in the bottom of a pair of shoes, how about it? Now, whether he'd seen, heard, or what, about spikes in the bottom of running shoes, I don't know. So some people say he invented it. Others, he's a pioneer. So we'll leave it as a pioneer, because spikes have been around for a while. And so he made himself a pair of shoes. As a cobbler, he obviously knew how to make a pair of shoes. Yeah. And these were hand-sewn shoes. They made inside out, and then you turn them around and then put the outer sole on. So he did that, made himself a pair of spike running shoes. And, of course, He did a lot better than usual when he was out in the next race. In fact, he came second, which was most unlikely.
Wow, so they obviously had an impact.
Oh, indeed it is. And that was the start of his business. So if we're going through the family, we can say that his grandfather was a cobbler. Cobbler's not exactly a shoemaker, but grandfather, as a cobbler, turned into a shoemaker. Then, of course, my father and uncle took over the business from grandfather. So you could say that Jeff and I were third generations as far as shoemaking is concerned.
Mm,
Amazing.
Mad. So what propelled you into the family business then? Why didn't you reject it and become a confectioner, for example? You know, why did you go, you know...
Why did he reject it?
No, why didn't you reject becoming continuing in the shoemaking, you know, in the athletic field, and you decided to go, no, I don't want to do any of this. I want to become, go back to what we originally did, was become a confectioner.
Well, as in the book, I say I'm a lousy shoemaker. I would even be a worse confectioner, I'm sure. Making cakes wouldn't have fixed if I still had some, or if I did that, I could send you some and you could test out whether any good at confectionery. I guess I was brought up, but you've got to think that I was born in 1935. My grandfather died in 33, and I was born on his birthday in 1935. So that, unfortunately, grandmother, she's a bit of a firebrand. He's brought his name with him. That was it. I've named after my grandfather. So I'm Joseph William. He was Joseph William. And I'm born just 4 years before World War II. So my upbringing was really 6 years of blackouts. And, you know, when you're a kid, that doesn't matter. That's life, isn't it?
You don't know any different, do you? That's how you get on, and that's it.
You don't know different. So it was great fun in the dark, you know, knock a door and run and all those sort of things, the games you play as kids. And I was 10 before the war was over. And I had 7 years of education, college, before joining the company.
Yeah. Wow. And the thing is, so basically you already had a desire to join the family business. You know, it was something that interested you.
Well, I guess in those days, you follow a family business. Mm-hmm. I was educated in engineering, and I could have been probably what would now be British Aerospace. I could have been working for them. I think at the time it was De Havilland Propellers, because they made the propellers there in Bolton, well, just outside Bolton. So, and I had an interview and quite interested, but as a kid, your mind's full of everything, isn't it? You know, I want to do whatever. So I don't suppose I'd made my mind up before joining the company, learning a bit about shoes.
And you wasn't athletically inclined either. You was just like more, you know, just like thinking this is something that I can do.
Well, I wasn't inclined to running. I didn't particularly like running. I was pretty good at sprinting. I could manage to sprint. In fact, I did win a prize. You probably read it in the book. But I played badminton. I was more for a game, more for that sort of thing, more just that sort of sport. And I was doing all right at badminton. Yes.
Yeah. Joe, you mentioned in the book that you had to leave the family business to go and do your national service, and that when you came back, you felt almost like you were a different person. Did that have an impact, you think, on your decision for you and your brother as well, to kind of go off and do your own thing, to split with the family and create your own sports shoe company?
Well, there's no doubt it made the difference. Going away, mother's no longer sort of making your food or doing your washing. You go away, you're in the forces, and you've got to learn how to look after yourself. And they teach you an awful lot about that. I mean, it was 2 years, but 12 months of that 2 years, I got myself into a position where I was playing badminton for 12 months. I was not doing the usual. I was a radar operator by training, and that's where I should have been, doing the radar, which I did for 12 months. It's quite interesting. But the other 12 months, I was way off playing badminton in various and different RAF stations and whatever. So that was great fun. But what it did do, it taught you to, I'd like to do that. So how do I do it? And you do the right things to get to the right people. And so I played badminton. So when we came back, Jeff and I went away at the same time. Although he's 2 years older than me, we did national service at the same time. He did his in Germany. And he saw Adidas, he saw Puma, he saw they were not different. So when we came back and we're looking at the parent company, and we're saying, look, guys, you know, this is a failing company. It's dying. It was still making the same product that we're making in 1930s. And so, you know, we've got to move on. How do we move on? And we were trying to get them to move on. No. But you see, the problem was that father and uncle, I think it was about 6 years apart as far as their ages, and they just did not get on. In fact, they were feuding. you've Ooh. Probably yeah, out there shooting. You probably read about Adi Dassler and
It just seemed to be a sort of a thing, you know. You're gonna have two brothers feuding, and then some things happen off the back of that.
Well, there seems to be something there, doesn't there? It's something in the water or whatever it is. There's something that creates that, because Rudy went off to do Puma, but unfortunately, with father and uncle, they just stayed feuding. So nothing happened. And I would speak to my father and say, look, we've got to move. We've got to do this, got to do that. And all he would say to me is, look, Joel, when I'm gone and Bill's gone, this is yours. You can do what you like with it.
Right.
The answer was, Dad, we don't want you to go. Well, that's not the idea. No. But this company will be dead before you are.
Yeah.
It will be gone. It's going nowhere. And
so you had to make some big sacrifices then, personally, you know, and professionally, I guess, to make it happen.
Well, you know, I was 23, Jeff is 25.
Yeah.
At that age, we'd just done 2 years national service. We're indestructible. Mm, you know,
right.
It's just, what do? You do these things. Mm. This was going to be our future. The sacrifice, well, no, it was a challenge. And I think all through my life, I've enjoyed the idea of a challenge. So this was more of a challenge. If father won't do it, father won't come with us, if they can't get together. And, you know, we did as much as we could with Jerry Fawcett. I even introduced two new shoes, because at one point, father, he had tuberculosis and went away for 18 months. And we got a hold of the company. And we could work with our uncle. That wasn't the problem. We can work with him, and he was very happy to let us do whatever we wanted. So we introduced two new shoes. That was fine. But of course, we weren't running the company. And when father came back, it was just the same story. Nowhere to go. So Jeff and I decided we'd go to college, night college, learn a bit about shoemaking, because what we knew off the factory floor. Well, that's how they did it there. But we didn't know materials. We didn't know all the new things that were going on. And we'd seen Adidas. We'd seen Puma. You know, we wanted to modernize. And the best thing that happened with going to that college is we made a lot of connections, a lot of people in the industry. So we were able to ask questions. Where do we get needles from? Where do we get this from? It was great. And that helped us set up our own factory 6 miles down the road in Bury.
Wow. Did you ever do your research by analysing what your competitors were doing? So, you know, you'd go buy their shoes, their products, and you'd like rip them apart, deconstruct them, and see what made them tick.
Well, I don't think we could afford to buy shoes in those days. I think if you're in a business, and let's put it this way, the footwear business is not high tech. There's quite a bit of tech in there, but it's not high tech. You don't have to rip something apart. You can look at it and you can say, I know how that's made.
Right.
You know, I know. That's easy. We can do that. And so we did. So we knew. Plus the fact we went to Rossendale College, and Rossendale College knew all about shoemaking.
Right.
So
right.
So we could pick up. I think on the odd occasion during my existence, I think I bought one pair of Adidas and one pair of Nike. And that was just to sort of say, well, I'll put them on and see how comfortable they feel, how good they are. But within 30 years, that's all, just one pair of each.
Wow. Oh, really? Wow. So you've never worn any of your competitors' shoes? Well, apart from those,
I'd say just one pair. Yeah. That was it. Yeah, but I play badminton, so you know, what good would it be me to test these things out? you need people who actually. Jeff actually was a good athlete. Mm. Well, I say he was a good athlete. He was probably a bit like grandfather, but he pushed himself far too hard. Uh-huh. He pushed himself, and he was physically sick after he'd either been in an athlete's running race or he'd been cycling. He used to do 100-mile cycle races as well. So he was the keen sort of athlete we were making shoes for. Me, I was playing badminton, but we didn't make badminton shoes. Totally different product altogether.
Yeah. How did it feel then when you did go your own way? How did it feel, you know, you and your brother? Was it, you must have had this kind of sense of freedom that you're kind of finally, you know, setting your own destiny.
Yeah, I mean, it was... let's put it this way, we'd little option. If we were going to earn a living, and if we were going to stay in this business of sports football, we had to make a decision to move. So I guess the feeling was, yeah, we've done it. We're on our own. Yeah. And it wasn't so dramatic to say, well, what sacrifice have we made? Okay, I'd been married 12 months, 18 months, and had a nice new bungalow, and we had to sell that. But it was on a mortgage, but, you know, we had to sell that. And actually, we went to live with my my wife's parents for a while, and then we lived at the factory because the factory had some decent living accommodation with it. It faced onto a main road, a decent living. You know, we could live with that. And I can go back to the fact we were young. Okay. It didn't matter. You know, both Jeff and I had been scouts and Boy Scouts, and we used to camping and doing things for ourselves. So we knew a bit. Between being in the scouts and being in the forces, we were very self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could think on your feet. You know, you could you know, you showed initiative, you showed tenacity, and didn't really take no for an answer. You know what I mean? So that's absolutely brilliant. So, but one thing that Jason and I, you know, are fascinated about is that, you know, Reebok wasn't obviously the original name. How did that come into being? You know, I mean, did you go through a few iterations before, you know, going from JW Foster and Sons to Reebok? What was the process between and leading you to the formation of the name as Reebok?
Well, yeah, well, when we left the Foster company, we couldn't call ourselves JW Foster. Even both Jeff and I are JW Fosters. We thought, we can't do that because, you know, the parent companies down the road just called JW Foster's and Sons Athletic Shoes. So you can't really use that. So I came up with the name Mercury. I like the idea of Mercury Quicksilver. That's pretty good. And, you know, the winged messenger was our logo.
Yeah.
Great. It was fantastic. Let's do that. Yeah. And, you know, we were doing quite nicely. In fact, 18 months after being in business, and our accountant was looking at our numbers and said, you're doing all right, guys. Mm-hmm. But you better register your name. Just a minute, what do you mean, register your name? What's all this about?
What are you talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, register your name because if somebody else says, I like these Mercury shoes, we can make Mercury shoes. And if somebody else starts making Mercury shoes and you've not registered that name, you're going to have a lot of trouble because it means going to court, it means all sorts of things to prove that you were the first making the Mercury shoes. Okay, fine. How do we do that? Well, we'll contact the register of business names. We contacted the register. Mercury's pre-registered. Somebody else had got it.
Oh.
British Shoe Corporation, would you believe? Yes.
Oh, wow.
And they weren't using it. They had it registered, but they were not using it. So they offered it to us for £1,000. Wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just left. We just bought machinery at £25 a time. You know, £1,000. Yeah, right. How can we do that?
Put £1,000, yes, £1,000 into context around that time. In now terms, what are we looking at?
Oh, it would be probably 100,000, something like that. It could have been 1,000,000. It didn't care what was asking. It was too much.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the accountant said, go see the agent. So I saw an agent, and the agent said, well, we can buy it off them because they'll offer it to you. They are offering it to you for £1,000, and we couldn't pay that. Or you can take them to court. And I said, how much would that cost us? He said, about £1,000. So I said, well, no way there. No, it was a nice May, sunny day, and his window was open. And he said, well, you're going to have to get a new name. Bring me a new name. He said, I need at least 10. And I'm saying, it's 10. How do you do that? 10 names. But he pointed through the window, and he pointed to Kodak. Kodak. I said, well, what's with Kodak? He said, well, it means exactly what it means. That company, it's a made-up name. Everybody knows Kodak, and that's it. So if you can bring me a made-up name, well, you got it. So I went back and we sit around the table and we're thinking of names like Cougar, Falcon, you know, aggressive names. Sporting. We've got a list of these. Then let me take you to 1943. I'm 8 years old and I win a race, a 60-yard race, and I get a prize. And I go up to collect my prize. And what do I get? A dictionary. Yeah, come on, kids, what's the football? I'm 8 years old. A dictionary. Yeah, but it was an American dictionary. So they're trying to teach me the wrong words anyway. An American dictionary. Of course, I was pretty disgusted at the time. But we come forward now to 1960 and we're looking for a name. And I pick up my Webster's dictionary and I like the letter R. I thought, R, it's nice, strong. So I turn to R and then start leafing through from R. Soon I come across R-E-E-B-O-K, Reebok. That sounds good. What is it? Small South African gazelle. Gazelle. Wow. Gazelle. That's absolutely perfect. Top of the list. Back to the agent.
Yeah.
We want this one. Forget all the other ones. We want this one. And as it happened, it was the only one that came out that we could actually use freely. There were two possible objections. One was Railbrook, which was is it Tootles? They made shirts. And the other one was Rebo, and this was women's underwear. And our agent said, Rebo, that's no problem. And Railbrook, I happen to be Tootles' agent as well. So I can tell them there's no objection. So there was no objection. However, really? Yeah, the registrar came back and said, but we can only put you in part B of the register. You know, we'd only just heard of a register, never mind a part B. Why part B? They said, but if somebody comes to me or to you and they're making shoes out of Reebok skin, we can't stop them. Well, Jeff and I look at each other and think, is that going to happen? Nah. So we register Reebok in part B of the register. However, 20 years later, the registrar came back to us to say, we've moved you to part A of the register.
Oh.
Yes, sir. Why? He said, well, everybody now knows that Reebok is a sports shoe.
Yeah.
It's not an animal.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. So that's how we got Reebok.
Wow.
Amazing.
So what? Yeah. So what shoes were you making? What was the first Reebok? You know, you've got the name Reebok. You know, and it sounds pretty dominant, and it's very distinctive, especially in consideration to your competitors. You know, but what products were you deciding to put out then? What were the models on in the range, as it were?
Well, we've been very good. We didn't think we wanted to compete with our parent family were more involved in athletic shoes those days. Mm-hmm. They made athletic shoes, boxing boots, wrestling boots. They made wrestling boots for all the top wrestlers, which is quite amazing.
Wow.
the Mick McManus and people like that, if you know those old names,
they
used to make these specially. So they were in that. But we said, okay, well, Jeff was a cyclist, so why don't we do cycle shoes? Mm-hmm. So we had a range of cycle shoes. We started off Mercury cycle shoes. This was great. And one of the local cyclists, who was quite a good cyclist, in his training, he asked if he could take the shoes and go around and visit shops. So he did. So he became our agent. And he's Carlin shops doing very well, and we advertised in Cycle magazine, and from Cycle magazine we got another agent in London. He was actually a Scot, moved to London. I don't know why he moved to London, but he did, and he was an agent. He was a salesman. I don't know what else he sold. He must have sold frames and wheels and whatever, but he was well respected. And all of a sudden this guy was literally snowing us down with orders, loads of orders. We had to employ
to get
people in to work for us. Brilliant. But also, Jack was in the local athletics club, and a lot of local athletes started to come to us, and we started to make athletic shoes. So we were then making athletic shoes for clubs and for the schools. But all of a sudden, our cycle shoe business just died.
Ooh.
And you've got to take yourself back to the early 60s. The only way of communication, really, was a letter. You know, picking up a telephone, there was no mobile phones, we had no computers. So the guy, he's out on the road selling there in London. And for three weeks, we got no orders. Then we got a letter from his landlady. And his landlady said, do you owe Mr. Oh, I've forgotten his name now. Do you owe him any money?
Uh-huh.
And she went on to say, because he was killed in a road accident 3 weeks ago.
Oh, no, no.
And that just killed our saddle business.
Yeah.
We continued with a bit, but we never got that back from that. I mean, he was sending hundreds. You know, we were literally snowed down with making saddle shoes. But that died, and we moved more into the athletic side. Because the different shops, you know, the sports shop is different from the cycle shop, and you know, the cycle shops, they were selling the shoes. So we moved more into athletics at that point.
And were you competing with J.W. Foster and Son, the parent company, then, and what they were producing as well at the same time?
Well, by that time, my uncle had died.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had decided that he recognised his business wasn't there anymore.
Mm.
So he closed the J.W. Foster's down, and he opened a sports shop.
Mm.
outside of a local area, he just decided he would open a sports shop and sell his sports shoes. So there was no competition anymore. J.W. Foster's has, had we had predicted, it we would die.
Yeah.
It had died.
So did your father's shop carry Reebok then?
Yes. Oh, yes. He carried Reebok, of course.
What was his thoughts on it then? Was he like going, son, I have to sit you down. I was wrong. You were right. Did he do any of that, or did he just plow on, just like, you know, just not acknowledging that, but just, you know, the cosign of it being in the shop was enough.
Yeah, I think that over sort of 2 to 3 years that this took, the whole thing had sort of become acknowledged. Fine, yes, you've gone off. Yes, and you know, the Foster product, whilst there's still a demand, he had to admit it wasn't really enough. Plus the fact that when my uncle died, with him died the hand-sewn side of the business.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because you've probably heard of Walsh, Norman Walsh.
Yes.
Walsh. Well, when we were there, Norman worked for Uncle Bill on the hand-sewn side of the business. And my father did the machine sewn side of the business. This is why they were separate. They had their own set of books. It was amazing. Anyway, Norman worked, but when Uncle Bill died, Norman decided, like us, he would leave and set up his own little shop, which he did, but he only ever stayed as a one-man operation. Mm-hmm. And he did nice business, but he concentrated on sort of fell running, the sort of running that is there in Lancashire. It's orienteering. He did that sort of product, and he made a nice thing. Plus, I talked about wrestling boots. He took over that side of the business. He took the wrestling boot business, and he was making these wrestling boots. And they were amazing things. I don't know if there's still any photographs on them, but they were sort of above the calf and all sorts of fancy motifs on them. But, so Norman left and Norman did that. So the business, that side of the business had gone from J.W. Foster. Mm-hmm. And so the machine sewn side, well, father decided that, yes, he would need to restart his business. And at I think he was in his late 50s at that point. There's no restarting business. You know, I don't know why Uncle Bill and my father did not have the drive that obviously grandfather had. I mean, grandfather had 3 world records in 1904. He had gold medals in the first decade. And in 1920s, you know, he had gold medals from Eric Liddell, Harold Abrahams, and Lord Burley. They all wore his shoes, and they're the ones immortalized in Chariots of Fire. So during the 20s, he had so many people wearing this product, gold medals, and he influenced people. He knew what influencing was. But then it wasn't street. It didn't come street until after World War II. He influenced other athletes to buy his shoes. So he had a good business. But whether there were 2 world wars that really stopped my uncle and father from really having any energy left to drive the business, you know, I can only put it down to that, you know, they were doing business, or grandfather was doing business in the first decade, then World War I, then there was the 20s, and then, of course, we got the 40s, where we again got another war. So whether that sort of robbed them of the feeling that they're in a business, I don't know, but that didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways you can understand why, given the rigors, you know, that they must have been through. But for you, you know, I guess kind of we're about in the 1960s now. And, you know, the running boom obviously came along. And a lot of people, you know, Reebok means running. You know, how did that whole running boom affect you? Did it suddenly change everything? Did you kind of start to focus more on running?
Well, we were in running before the boom came in, because we used to deal with track and field. And field, and there were clubs all over the country. Every town had a running club or whatever. And I used to go around to the sports stores and take my stuff and say Reebok and the usually an ex-footballer who was running this sports store in those days. He would look and say, "Well, Joe, I've got Adidas here and I've got Dunlop here." He said, "Why do I need Reebok?" That to me was that question, and that came up more than once. That came up so many times. And I think, why does he need Reebok? He doesn't need Reebok.
Yeah,
I've got to make him need Reebok. This is not this is not where I'm going. I'm not going to my consumer here. I'm going to somebody who doesn't know what I am.
Yeah.
So in those days, really fortunate that the 3A's, the Amateur Athletic Association, they had a handbook. In that handbook, there must have been 200-300 clubs. And there was the name and address of every secretary.
Wow.
That was it. That was it. 300 letters, out they go, offering 15% discount. And if somebody wanted to be an agent, they could have the discount and so on. I got well over 100-150 agents. And Ron Hill was included in one of those agents.
He started
as being an agent. But, and many others who eventually opened sports shops. And they, so we've got this business. It's great. And then the retailers, the sports stores started phoning. They would say, look, I know when you're selling direct to athletes and like if you we'll stock your shoes if you stop doing that. Okay, that means now I've created a pull. I've created a demand. They want. Yeah. But I said to them, look, guys, I know what you're saying, but I only give them 15% off. I'm not going to stop selling them. That's not what I'm going to do. But if you want to sell them, you'll get wholesale prices and we'll publicize the fact that you stock our shoes.
Yeah.
I think I got 90% of the retailers to back that. So that was great. But, you know, athletics, it wasn't a big business. You know, running was not big in the early 60s. In fact, it was quite small. You know, the big business was football. But Adidas and the Puma, they had that sewn up. You know, to get into that would have cost so much money. We didn't have it. We just didn't have it. But, you know, I'd got my eyes on America. Foster's, in fact, was selling 200 pairs a month at one time to America, to Yale University. Frank Ryan and Bob Ginger, they were the coaches there. And they used to buy them in and then they would sell them on to other universities. So I've got to get into America. And it so happened. We're talking now 1968. And I'm reading a magazine and the Board of Trade, the government, wanted to help the sports trade export. And what they would do is they'd provide us with a stand at the NSJ show, which is the National Sporting Goods of America in Chicago. They provided with a stand, return at a fair, and 50% of our expenditure whilst we're at the hotels and meals and whatever.
Well,
cheaper than staying at home.
Yeah. Sounds like a good deal.
So I happen to have a good friend, Bob Brigham at the time, Bob Brigham, Ellis Brigham. I don't know if you know the campus shops.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we used to make a lightweight climbing boot, a rock climbing boot for him. So I was a good friend with Bob, and Bob said, well, you know, let's go along together. So we took this and we went to America together. We went to New York first to look at some of the outdoor stores. Bob went to the outdoor stores. I went to the sports stores. Then we went on to Chicago when it's cold. Cold in February.
Yeah.
I've never been so cold in my
windy
life.
Windy city, isn't it?
Really cold. But anyway, we're at the show and I get a lot of people coming up saying, oh, I like your shoes. Where do we get them from? And I'm saying, England. And they look at me and say, is that New England? And no, not New England. Oh, the idea, is that near London? You know,
is that near London? I love it.
Yeah, it's near London. So, so I didn't get any orders. Bob actually got some orders, which was good because we were making the boot for him. So that was okay. I think the outdoor trade, we used to import in skis and things like that. But the sports stores, no, they'd got no clues. They didn't want to know. And it was like, okay, when you get somebody over here where you've got a stock over here, we'd love to try your shoes. It's 1968. I got there. I got into America. I got a distributor in 1979.
Wow.
11 years.
Yeah.
11 years to take for that step to happen.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I had six attempts, six failures, if you will, because there were three people and different people at different times in California, one in Massachusetts, and they tried, but there was something missing. And it was a bit like when I was in the UK going around to the sports stores. You know, why do I need Reebok?
Yeah.
Why? And this is the same problem in America. We needed to find the hook. We needed something to happen. Now, we talk about luck. And you were talking about the running boom. Well, the running boom was really going big in America before it even touched the shores of UK.
Right.
It was really growing. In the late 60s, it started, and it turned out to be a magazine. It was really a sort of an A4 page. It was Runner's World. Runner's World came out. By 1975, this was a full-blown, full-color magazine.
Wow.
Yeah, fantastic. And Bob Anderson, who was the publisher, we made a point of actually one on occasions going over to Chicago to travel on to his place in California and meet up with him, have words with him and whatever. And we used to advertise in Runner's World, but the cost of advertising in Runner's World started to grow. Really started to begin. We're thinking, how can we afford this? We have no distribution, but we're paying for advertising. Anyway, Bob Anderson, in his wisdom, decided that he could tell everybody which was the best shoe in the world.
Yeah.
So in his August edition, he made it his shoe edition. And he said, this is the number one shoe. And I think it was Nike Tailwind.
Oh, right.
Okay.
So that's around 79?
Well, it's before that.
Because the Tailwind came out to the public, I think, 79. But yeah, sorry.
Well, you may know better than we only care. It was a Nike shoe anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
And Phil Knight is importing these from Onitsuka.
I would be the Cortez. I think it'd be the Corsair or something like that. Yeah.
But he was importing them. And somebody says your number one shoe in America, 400 million people, of which probably a million are running, maybe 2, 3, 5, 10 million are running. Mm-hmm. So he's receiving orders from sports stores for over a million pairs. You know,
incredible.
But could he get those? No. No chance to import those. It takes 12 months for that to build up. And by the time he got the product to give to the retailers were saying, fine, thanks. But Bob Anderson is then saying, we now have another number one shoe. And it wasn't the Tailwind or whatever it was. It wasn't the first shoe.
Mm-hmm.
So they're now stuck with a lot of shoes coming in. All of a sudden, there's another number one. This happened for 2 years. Then I think somebody got to Bob and said, Bob, you can't do this. You're destroying the whole business. This is no good.
Yeah.
So the next year, he decided we'd have star ratings instead. 5-star would be the best. And you could get 4 5-star shoes. That was it.
Right.
I knew how to build a 5-star shoe.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been difficult to build a number one since we weren't in America, but I knew we could build a 5-star shoe, and I did. And that the result of that was Aztec.
Aztec was built
as a 5-star shoe. We tested this out. We had Aztec as a trainer. We had Midas as a road racing shoe. And we had Inca as a spike. And we tested this out in Edmonton at the Commonwealth Games in 78. We got a shed load of medals. We did really well. We did a lot of top athletes there. We got Jenkins, Pasco, Capes, you know, these people. What was she called?
Jeff Capes wore Reebok. Brilliant.
Yes.
World's strongest man, wasn't he?
Yes. Jeff Capes wore Reebok. Yes. We were very good friends at the time. And I remember crawling on his house and he showed me his budgies because he bred budgies at one of his things. So we did really well. So this is 78. And in February of 79, I'm back to the NSGA show with my gold range and in particular Aztec. And along came Kmart.
Mm-hmm.
They want 25,000 pairs. Oh, great.
Whoa.
6 months worked that for our factory back in Bolton. Well, you know, we knew we were going for 5 stars. We knew if we got 5 stars, we needed help. And I had a friend at Barter. He just set up the sports division. And Shaq said, look, if you get orders, we'll make them for you. Fantastic. Mm. That's great. But Kmart said, we want a better price. Okay, well,
always, we're bulk buying here. Cut us a deal.
But we were aware at that point that product was going to the Far East. Mm-hmm. And so we had contact with HS Corporation through the London agent. And HS Corporation were South Korea. Mm-hmm. So we knew that we could better the price, but that would take a little time to get there.
Mm.
So great, fantastic. But then along came Paul Fireman.
Right.
he was also exhibiting there with his small Boston camping. They were wholesalers, tents, fishing rods, you name it. And yeah. I could, you know, and Paul saying, "Joe, I'd love to be your agent." And I could see from me to them, is thinking about Boston camping. He'd probably been there for 10 years. Mm-hmm. He was running this with his brother and his brother-in-law. Mm. And yeah. and I could see Paul is not, he's not happy with what he's doing. Mm. Okay, fine. But we're now in February and the shoe edition is not going to come out until August. And Paul is saying, we need a five-star shoe. I'd love to do it, but I need a five-star shoe. I said, Paul, come here. Look at this. This is Aztec. This mm-hmm. is, yeah, but it's not got five stars. No, it will have five stars. Mm. Ah, okay. Look, Joe, we really need the five stars before we can go. I said, that's okay. But bear it in mind, I went back to America and I met up with Kmart. I also went to see Boston Camping. Nice little operation there that with all the bits and pieces. Yeah, that's good. However, we're in the last week of July in 79. The August edition is now out on the kiosks there in America. And mm-hmm. I phoned Paul. I think I got him out of bed because he's a bit sort of dozy and slow to react. Oh, right, Joe. Right. Yeah. I said, can you get down to the local kiosk and pick up a Runner's World? It's bound to be out there now. An hour later, he came back. He said, Joe, Aztec, as you said, five stars. Wow.
Five stars. Yeah.
That was it. We'd got that hook. It. We'd got the pull instead of the yeah. push. We got that.
Yeah.
That was the difference. But he said, you know, Midas and Inca, in their categories, they also got five stars.
Wow. And
there we are. Three shoes, five stars. We're in business.
Mm. Brilliant.
You're a five-star brand. You are like that five-star hotel. Reebok is five-star athletic shoes.
Absolutely. Mm. So we'd arrived in America, and this was the... this was the beginning of orders to come in. Okay, Paul had to get into the things. His first 20,000 pairs he ordered, we got them made at Bata. what a problem. Bata, biggest company and shoe company in the world, had their own rubber factory.
Yes.
So they were making the EVA sponge, and at some point they hadn't cured it enough. So some of these shoes, you'd running on them, maybe not too far, maybe for 2 or 3 hours, and they just flattened. They just went and lost it. This is going to be death. But Paul Feynman, all he did, he just replaced them with what stock he got. And he never paid for those shoes. Because also, how can you pay for them? Sorry, we don't know which are going to fall apart. So that probably helped him during the first 6-9 months to stay alive until we got Korea on board.
Mm.
He, as I say, he got a credit line from Bata, but when you go to Korea, it's letters of credit. You don't get any credit. You've got to have the money.
Yes,
you've got to be willing to pay.
Yeah,
so that became the problem. How would we get the cash from? We were doing quite nicely, thank you, but the demand over there, we hadn't got the cash to build it. Paul hadn't got the cash, and I went across to see Paul, and Paul drives me to his office, and I say, "This isn't Boston Camping, was it?" Oh, we're closed. And I knew he wasn't keen on Boston Camping. He'd closed the company. They'd closed down.
Okay.
Yeah. I was thinking Boston Camping, little operation, nice wholesale, nice bolt-on to begin with. No, closed the business. His brother was making wallets somewhere, and his brother-in-law had opened a second-hand car lot, and Paul was there on his own. Reebok. Yeah. Okay. So, he had a limited amount of money. Mm. And I remember going to different places. Went to the Empire State Building to meet this guy who, he sourced product in the Far East. He used to bring product in. Sourcing product, that was one way of financing your company. And we met with him. And he said, about 18 months ago, I turned down Nike. Nike came to me to see if I would fund their operation because Nike had a lot of problem getting funded.
Wow. Yeah.
And he said, I turned them down. He said, and I'm going to turn you down as well because I don't want to be the person who's known to have turned down, to have been the loser of the two. I turned down Nike and to then put my money into something which possibly would fail. So he turned us down as well. So he lost out on both.
Yeah.
But Paul had a friend. It was Built Right Rubber. They made rubber soles and heels, Built Right of America. And he had this friend. And this friend was a good friend of Stephen Rubin's.
Okay.
And so he knew Stephen Rubin, Pentland. You probably know them as JD Sports these days as well.
Yeah.
And Pentland, they operated Asco, which was Associated Shoe. And they were actually sourcing product from the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
And what Stephen wanted Paul to do, he said, yes, we'll fund you. He wanted Paul to call on Sears, Roebuck, all the big chain stores in America, mm-hmm. and do own brands for them. You know, we can make it your brand and we can make it at half the price you're paying now. Paul said, no, we're not doing that. We're Reebok. And he stuck to that. But
we haven't gone all the way, you know, putting blood, sweat and tears to deliver a 5-star product, traveling all over the world for you to go hang about. We just want to do, you know, a half, you know, a dumbed down version of everything.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
You're listening to Soulful Sneaker Stories, a Soho Radio original.
You know as well as I know, the thing that happened for Reebok was Aerobix.
Yeah.
And Aerobix, that was our angel, or Angel Martinez, down in LA. He was a tech rep. And as a tech rep, he just called on stores and he would just show them why they should buy shoes. I think he only just missed out on becoming an Olympic athlete. I don't think he made it.
Oh, really? Okay.
But he was a real good athlete. He was very good. But he was also a better salesman, fantastic salesman. I mean, he was probably one of the most incredible people that Reebok really took on.
Uh-huh.
And he's down in LA, and his wife Frankie is coming back from these aerobic classes, full of it, with her girlfriends. Oh, they're absolutely full of this. Fantastic.
The Jane Fonda effects, right?
Well, it wasn't Jane Fonda yet.
Oh,
really? So this is
pre-Jane Fonda. Wow.
Pre-Jane Fonda, yes.
Okay.
Pre-Jane Fonda. He's coming. And so Arnold said to Frankie, can I come down to your next class and have a look at this? Which he did.
Yeah.
Saw the instructor there in trainers, half the class in trainers, the other half no trainers. It struck him, why don't we make a nice glove leather shoe with a nice cushion just for these girls? And
yeah,
it's great. Off he goes up to Paul Feynman. You know, Paul's in Boston. He's see, Paul, this fantastic thing's going on down in there. And I think you may have different, we all have different interpretations at this point, because everybody's been involved in Reebok from their point of view. Paul will probably tell you different. Anna will probably tell you different. I can only now say the story as I knew it. And the story as I knew it, Anna went up to see Paul in Boston. And Paul tells Paul about what's going on in LA. And Paul is sort of saying, look, Anna, we're doing great on running. We're doing great. Forget it. Arnold didn't forget it. He went round to see Steve Ligaton, who was the product man. Maybe 200 pairs, Steve. I think this is going to be great.
Yeah.
Steve made him the 200 pairs, and he got them down there and gave them to the instructors. And the whole thing really took off. Yeah. The girls loved them so much. Not only were they wearing them for the aerobics, they just put them on the feet and wore everywhere they went to work. They did everything. They just loved them.
Yeah.
You know, after about 6 weeks, they've been made of glove leather. Glove leather just tears.
Right. So very soft, but not very strong.
Oh, so it's not very strong at all. I mean, we had used glove leather. We used glove leather for World 10, our World 10 road racing shoe. But we used it in reverse, so we had the suede side out.
Right. Yeah. Which was tough, right. And then it was softer. You know, for the foot on the inside. Yeah.
Absolutely. But we had also strengthened it with nylon. But, you know, it's only about 1 millimeter thick. If you consider this leather's in fact, it was less, about 0.7 of a millimeter. And you've got to take the surface off in order for the adhesive to go in there so you can stick a sole on. So these were busting apart. 6 weeks, they're falling apart. But, you know, we're talking about USA. We're talking about Los Angeles. The girls didn't care.
Yeah.
They loved them so much, they went out and bought a new pair.
It was the 80s, wasn't it? Conspicuous spending, yeah.
This thing then started to explode, and that's when we get people like Jane Fonda. Jane Fonda, right. She goes out and buys a pair of shoes, a pair of Reebok, to use in her videos. Well, we just became...
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And the explosion started. Okay, the explosion started down in Los Angeles, and it took years to sort of develop over. But we were doing about $9 million at that point.
Incredible. Wow. You know,
and within a year, it was $30 million.
Wow.
Because this That's explosion was starting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then $90 million a year after.
Wow. Wow.
Then $300 million.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Oh, my. So, I mean, you must have just been pinching yourself at this point because,
well,
you know.
I don't think we had time to do that. It was it was just chasing the business, and I was going around the world putting on new distribution.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd be in Australia, being all over the place, putting distribution out, and this was just growing tremendously. So we were feeding more orders in around the world because everybody wanted aerobics.
Yeah.
And so the year after, we were 900 million. We'd gone from 300 million to 900 million. Mm-hmm. Now, Stephen Rubin was supplying the product because he was given that credit line. And at first it was a bit of a problem, but once it started growing, we got over that problem. But can you consider what the next problem is? We're going from 300 million to 900 million.
Yeah.
Where do you get the product?
Yeah.
Right.
How can you triple your demand in product?
Yeah.
Well, luckily Nike at that point just hit a bad time.
Mm-hmm.
They hit a wall and they had to pull out from about three different manufacturing units in South Korea, and we just moved in.
Wow. But was that because of your success? Was that because of how well Reebok was doing?
Not really, because Reebok was we were in a new category. All of a sudden, running was running. We moved to a new category. Running itself had peaked. Yeah, you know, running itself by that time had got to the point in the late 80s where mid to late 86, 87. By that time, Nike had just sort of, they were struggling.
Yeah.
They had to broaden their offerings, really, and go into different things. Like, they were already starting in football, but basketball, all the other things that's to extend their business. But they hit that wall, and we managed with the aerobics to take up that production, which was fantastic.
And so was no one else really producing an aerobic shirt at that time? You literally cornered the market.
Well, all of a sudden, it's like, is aerobics, is it sport? Well, yes, it was sport, but people, it was women. Mm, people looked at Adidas and looked at Nike. They were male, sweaty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ah, but this Reebok company, they were doing nice in running, but not many people knew us. This was running. All of a sudden, we're hitting street. We're mainstream. What did Reebok do? They're the women's company. We became a women's company then. And that was it. And we just, and so the others looking on thinking, they probably didn't even think they should get into it because this was just women. And it was like, yeah, so they sat back and said, well, you know, it's just a craze, just a fad, it'll soon pass.
Okay. Yeah.
But of course, you know, by the time Reebok got to just under $4 billion in the end of 1989, we were number one. We'd overtaken Adidas, overtaken Nike. We were the number one shoe company.
That's right.
How did that feel? You know, because you'd been around for what, 20, 30 years at that point? Did you ever imagine when you and Jeff started the company that you would be the number one in the world, you know?
You don't do you? You start off in life trying to make a living because, you know, we knew the Fosters were failing. We knew we had to do something. And why not do what we'd learned to do? You know, we'd learned to make footwear. We got some traction there. So we went in. I don't think we dreamt at that point, but, you know, as we always wanted momentum. We always wanted to grow because I think you need to grow. And I think, you know, the energy that was lacking from my father and uncle and J.W. Foster's, we had it in abundance. You know, the biggest problem or saddest thing that happened in life was that we just got our 5-star rating, just got into America, when unfortunately Jeff developed stomach cancer and died. Yeah, I mean, so he didn't see where we went to.
We climbed up there.
He didn't, and that was a great shame. It meant a lot of different things for me, but it probably made me double my efforts if that was possible. And make sure that we're going to see this. We're going to get our way through it. So yes, we became number one. Things were happening so fast, incredibly fast that. I think it was Sports Goods Intelligence that told us we were number one.
Wow.
Sports Goods Intelligence, they put us down as Numero Uno, and they put Nike down as the Eager Beavertons. Mm. And I can't remember what they called Adidas. I can't remember it all.
Yeah.
But so this was interesting that we had got, I mean, also because we're in LA, we picked up on Hollywood. We were in Monte Carlo doing the Princess Grace Memorial things, the tennis tournament.
Right.
We had all the stars out there, including Frank Sinatra. You know, everybody was out there, Sean Connery, Roger Moore, and Charlton Heston used to be there, wow. Veronica Hamill. You know, there were so many people, John Forsythe, Linda Evans, all these people in Dynasty. And it was incredible. So we were living this.
Yeah, not bad for a boy from Bolton.
No, not at all. Yeah. One key thing that I always identify with the success of brands is how you brand it. And that's the key thing. And Reebok has had phenomenal success with branding in America, being what it is, and very brand focused and very logo centric. Reebok has had some strong imagery when it comes to branding. And obviously you have to have the product, but if it isn't branded correctly, obviously it doesn't, you know, the people don't understand it. You know, they need that sort of recognition, you know, like coded with the waveform, et cetera, et cetera. The star logo is of one thing of interest. How did that come into being? And Dark then rest. Also, and then also,
yeah.
you know, the incorporation of the Union Jack as well within the logo.
Yeah, some good stories in that one. Well, Jeff loved to work in a factory. That's all he wanted. He wanted to be in the factory and just make sure that we made the product. That's great. And and it was like, Joe, you do everything else. Yep. And he was just happy for me to do everything else. So I'm playing with the logo. I had a guy called Barry Oakes, who was an artist as well as an advertising guy, and worked together on numerous things. He brought in the Mototectura lettering. That's the dropped R.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was the same that Apple were using. Whether we were there before Apple, I don't know. I can't remember who was first, but we got the Mototectura lettering. But I kept on developing different things, and we changed our side stripes, the image. We had two stripes and a T-bar when we started as Mercury. We had that. And it was 4 years into our business when we got the letter from Adidas, from their solicitor, that we were infringing their three stripes.
Right.
So please desist.
Yeah.
And again, a bit like changing the name. Come on, we can get around this one. Yeah. It took only a few minutes for big smiles to appear on our faces and say, wow. We've been recognised. Adidas, no, we're here. Yeah. This is great.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Adidas. Now we've not got them scared, but we've got them writing letters to us. Wow, fantastic. So we changed our silhouette to the to what we see now as the vector, which is the arrow. And of course, we're now starting about how do you get your logo? Because we used to have the winged messenger with Mercury. That was our logo. Now we're trying to think, change your logo. So. Now we've got an arrow design. So looking at the arrow and I'm thinking, I put two of these together. Then we put the R at the back of the arrow. And I'm thinking, that looks great. Fantastic. But it's directional. You can put it on the right foot and it looks okay, but you can't put it on the left shoe.
Oh, I see.
It's wrong way around. So we're thinking of different, how can we handle this? So I end up saying, well, I've got these two arrow shapes. If I just carry on all the way around as a circle, it's non-directional. Then we can use that anywhere. And if we just light up those two arrows, that makes a nice logo. So that became the star crest.
Wow. Right. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Amazing.
Well, that's how it became great. Yeah. And I mean, I do think we took the arrow shape from the from those BOAC in those days, British Airways. Oh, yeah. Had an arrow on the tail. The speedbird had that arrow on the so we were partly using that. And of course I've taken this, and I'm in America with Paul, and we're talking about it, and Paul said, love the star crest, fantastic, looks a bit like the Union Jack, why can't we use the Union Jack? I'm saying, well, we can use it, Paul. Nothing's stopping us, but back in the UK, we're going to be in trouble if we use the Union Jack, because these shoes are coming from Korea. And the Union Jack has a bit of an indication they're made in the UK. I said, but go on. And Paul was saying, you know, the Star Crest is brilliant, but it's going to take a lot of money for us to get people to recognize it. But he said, everybody in the United States knows the Union Jack.
Right.
Everybody is, which is like a bit of an eye on free. Everybody in it, but you know, it became a fantastic point of sale because what we were doing is we put the Union Jack on each shoe, and we made the box a Union Jack box.
These are early
days. Point of sale is useful posters and whatever, but the retailers, they used to put the boxes in the shop windows. They used to stack them up like a pyramid with the lids facing forward. Union Jack. Yeah. And then they put a shoe on each of the levels of the pyramid going up. Fantastic point of sales. We used to have photographs of that somewhere, but that was incredible. And it was one of the sort of elements that helped explode the visibility of the brand. Yeah.
That must have looked amazing. Americans must have thought, you know, the Limeys are taking over our sports shops.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's the shoe of the Queen or something like that. And the Americans love the royal family. So it's just like, we're dipping into something that has an auspicious sort of air about it.
Yeah.
We did have loads of trouble in the UK.
Right.
I think we were sued about 20 different times by different local authorities. and we eventually came to an agreement because...
You're putting Britain on the map. Well, you're suing us, but we're putting Britain on the map, and we're killing it in America. What is your problem here?
We came up with all sorts of different arguments that most of the flags that people wave at these celebrations are probably made in Korea or certainly made in Asia, and they're waving flag. And British Airways used to have the flag on the back of their aircraft, and we're saying, you know, they put it on the back of Boeings. You know, they're flying Boeings on the Union Jack.
Made in America.
Absolutely. So, but we used to lose every one of them, and they used to fine us a pound.
Really?
I mean, it probably cost about £20,000 just to have a court case, but they fined us a pound. But it took us a while before we actually came to an agreement with, I think it was it Shopping Standards?
Trading Standards?
Trading Standards, they were the ones that were being prompted by local unionists to say, you've got to do this. But we came to that arrangement that make one payment, done, dusted, nobody else can do it again. but it was quite an experience doing that with the Union Jack. But, you know, when I was, it was late 80s, we were selling 5 million pairs of shoes a month.
What?
Wow. And if you think about that, there's two Union Jacks in a box on the shoes, and there's one on the lid. That's 15 million Union Jacks were going around the world every month. So, yes.
It had to be the most recognised flag in the world, all thanks to you and Reebok, you know?
I think it must have been well recognised before, but I think we did have a little bit at, taking advantage of why not. Yeah. And,
well, because people would be seeing the Union Jack on people's feet on the street everywhere. The only time you ever would see a Union Jack would be on an occasion, you know, or whatever, you know, be it a sporting event or celebration of the Queen's birthday or whatever, the Trooping of the Colour or whatever, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But internationally, people were seeing the Union Jack everywhere. It became probably one of the most recognised, you know, logos in the world. If you can refer to the Union Jack in a crass way as a logo, you know what I mean, the logo of Britain. But you know, it's like that's actually phenomenal.
Absolutely
phenomenal.
Exactly. Wasn't there an interesting story about how the famous Reebok, you know, the window on the show, on the shoe where you used to have the logo? How did that come about? Because I remember reading something interesting in the book about, wasn't it Sadco or something like that? Wasn't there some connection?
Yeah, well, during our sort of progress in Reebok, we bought two Saab Turbos. Jeff had one, I had one. Saab Turbo, wow. Yeah. We were moving up in life, so why not get a Saab Turbo?
Saab Turbo was one of my dream cars. You know? When growing up, it was like, I want a Saab Turbo one day.
It was quite good. I could tell you a story about it, but I better not do it on this at this time. so we were very well in with Saab in Manchester. And Saab in Manchester, Saab were actually sponsoring Sebco. They gave him a car, so, you know, they were sponsoring him. And so they invited me along to Manchester to meet up with Sebco. And they said, can you make him a shoe? And I said, well, look, come on, he's actually sponsored by Nike, so we can't put Reebok on it. I said, well, can you put Saab on it? And the guy at in Manchester went into his office and he brought out a couple of woven sort of labels that they used to use on clothing, Saab. And he gave them to me and said, you know, what can you do? I said, look, leave it with me. I'll see what I could do. Thought we could sell these on somewhere. But I'm driving back and I'm thinking, well, what can we do with it? And I thought, well, maybe the best way to do with it is on our arrows at the side. If we cut a window in and put Saab in behind it, maybe that's the neatest way of doing it, which we did. We made these shoes and I'm looking at these shoes and thinking, wow. That looks pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I have a photograph of me handing the shoes to Sebco. I've got that photograph.
Yeah.
I don't know if he ever wore them or whatever he did with them. Yeah. But
Phil Knight wouldn't have been too happy.
No, maybe not. But it was Saab on it. But of course, it had our side strap. It was our silhouette. So, you know, we were obviously, it was obviously a Reebok shoe. But I went back and I'm thinking, you know, that's really good. Why don't we do that? Instead of gold stamping, why don't we do that with Reebok? And I called in our man who did our label and said, look, this is what I want. And from then on, we put this label underneath and we had the window, which again was a really good, it was really good for the brand. It was really good visibility and it was different.
Yeah.
Definitely. It was still so distinctive.
Absolutely distinctive. One of the models that we associate that window with is the Reebok Classic. You know, you see that shoe on people's feet and it's boom, right there on the side. It's not obtuse. It's classy. It's clean and it works. But the Reebok Classic, I mean, what a phenomenal model and how synonymous that is with Reebok's footwearing history. How did it come into play, you know?
Well, Reebok came into play because once we got the leather right for aerobics, Reebok had changed the game. Nike really moved to nylon and suede, but we'd come in with a soft leather because normally leathers for footwear is very hard, it's very stiff, and it's okay because it stands up and it gives you a nice silhouette for the whole shoe. So they weren't made in soft leather. This had to be developed specially for Reebok. And now everybody uses the soft leather because you don't need to break the shoe in. And so this we moved from that to tennis. Mm-hmm. And for tennis, it was great. Nice, soft shoe. I remember Paul put an advert in the tennis magazines or something. And it was, if you don't think that Reebok tennis shoes are the best you've ever worn, we'll give you our balls. and this was headed up by Reebok puts their balls on the line. and it was a tremendous ad. And I said to Paul, that's a bit risky, isn't it? He said, well, he says, we've bought a couple of boxes of tennis balls. So that if anybody does return the shoes, we're going to give them a new pair of shoes and a whole tube of tennis balls.
Brilliant.
So I think in the end, Paul got through about half a box of tennis balls, that's all. Yeah. But it was a good ad. I mean, you know, and this is the sort of thing that really built the reputation. But we come to classics then as a spin-off, because all these shoes are being, they've now gone to street. Everybody's using these on the street to travel. If you went into any airport at that time, maybe 50% of the people traveling would be wearing a pair of Reeboks. And so it was a traveler's shoe. So classic became a shoe just really built for the street. So that anybody could wear it on the street. And I think it's still probably one of the best sellers that Reebok still has. It still sells very well.
People still love them, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, they do.
Still much loved, yeah. But so, Joe, I guess kind of where we are in the storyline, I mean, we're now kind of in the mid-80s, Reebok's biggest sports brand in the world. But you decided at that point that you were going to sell the company. And I suppose a lot of people would say, you know, why did you decide to do it then? So what was happening around that time that made you decide to do that?
Well, it was much earlier. And, you know, we've been struggling our life. How do you get around these problems? And we need finance. And to get the finance that was needed from Stephen Rubin, it was a question saying, you know, and Paul was pleading, look, Joel, you know, we got to keep this finance. We really need to get this. So I decided, okay. And I came to an arrangement with Paul, but it was a question of we need Reebok to take off. Reebok would have never taken off without the finance. Mm-hmm. And the finance wasn't my finance. It was coming from Moscow. It was coming from Pentland. And you need to keep people like that on board. And so they needed to have some ownership. So for me, it was a question of, okay.
Yeah.
This wasn't Joe Foster. This was Reebok.
Yeah.
Yeah, Reebok needed its future. And, you know, people do ask me, why did you sell? And I say, well, look, Reebok became number one. Mm. Because they say, you know, would you change anything? How can you change something when you become number one? Mm. When you actually do something and it works.
Mm. Yeah. So,
you know, yes, you could go back and say, I could change this. But it's like anything in life. If you could go back and change it, you know, you're changing the whole sequence.
Yeah,
you're changing what may happen afterwards. Mm. And, you know, I had a fantastic ride. It was absolutely fantastic. And when I left at the end of 1989, you know, I was probably at 35,000 feet more than I was on the ground. When I was traveling from one country to another, to one city, I would be picked up by a limousine. I'd be taken to the best hotel. We would go and dine at the best restaurants. And I'm talking, and then Reebok, we had a bunch of lawyers and another bunch of accountants and other people doing, how do you sort of work out how many boxes are going to go here? And so the challenge for me had gone.
Right. Do any of them pick up the phone? Yeah. Do any of them pick up the phone and go, Joe, we've got a bit of a problem here. What are your thoughts on this? Is that hotline still there?
Well, that hotline isn't there at the moment. I do have hotlines, and you've talked to Erin. You've talked to her. She's in the archives. She's a lovely girl, and she is really brilliant. She has one of my books as well, so I think probably a lot of information she gets from that. But I do have a hotline. In fact, she was in contact about 5 to 10 days ago. Mm-hmm. They've just come across some photographs. Ooh. that have turned up from 1964, 65, something like that, which all to do with those days with Reebok and the Foster connection. So she's actually posted them off to me. So within a few days, I'll probably be looking at these photographs and we'll maybe get some of those on Instagram. So
that'd be brilliant.
We need to see that. That's for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, I think it's really interesting. I mean, Kish and I talk about it a lot, and I kind of think that in some ways we kind of think that Adidas, really didn't do Reebok, the brand, its full justice. Mm. You know, I think for a long time, the brand seemed to be in a bit of a wilderness, which was a real shame. You know, it seemed like a kind of a squandered opportunity. Mm. But, you know, the brand's probably in the best place it's been in for a long time. And, I would love if suddenly, you know, Joe Foster was back at Reebok. I don't know if that could ever happen, but, that what a brilliant reunion that would be.
That would be, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm still here, and I'm pretty sure that when the auction is over that they're doing now, I'm pretty sure I'll have fairly good contact with the team again, Matt O'Toole, who's the CEO there. Yeah, mm-hmm. We know each other very well. We have exchanged in the past, but I think Adidas don't particularly want to have me as a confusion to what is going on. But yeah, you've got to give Adidas credit for two things. And one is they set up the archive about 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is really good. Mm. Yeah, they talked about it for about 6 years, but they actually set it up, which is something that Reebok we'd not done ourselves. A lot of my stuff, which I had in the attic and all over the place, that now is in Boston. Right. And we have Erin to look after that, and she's doing a superb job of that.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that, and I don't know what it is, when people buy a brand, they think they've got to do something with it. And so Adidas, when they took the brand on, they changed the lettering and they changed the logo to a delta.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, you know, you don't do that. You don't mess about with a brand. Exactly. It's like when you think of Ford, you know, and when I say Ford, you see this oval with Ford writing in it. Exactly, see Ford, they don't play around with it. That is your image. So you don't play around with an image. But I think we're going back now, maybe three years ago now, they got a new, I think they must have had a new marketing manager in at Adidas. And he just scrapped all these different things that they had going. And he came back to the Mototechura lettering and and the vector underneath. It's what I've got here on my... if I can feel it. They've come back to. So now that's brought back. We can recognize the brand again. Yeah, I think it's on the book also, which is just behind me up here.
That's right.
Yeah. So you get back to the vector, and that's your message, your message, your message, your message. And if you do that, you know, you're building your brand back again. People recognize it again.
Yeah,
but people lost touch with that. So two good things for Adidas, and now they're disposing of Reebok. I hope they have a good view of saying, let's give Reebok the best opportunity.
Mm.
Because, you know, Reebok are now 1.5 billion revenues. They're near to 20 billion. There's not a contest in that way, but they should enjoy the contest. They should enjoy and respect, you know, Reebok coming back to the market. Exactly. So they should... their choice should be the best choice for Reebok, not the best choice for Adidas, whichever that may be. But to me, the best choice for Reebok would be the best choice for Adidas. It would be, because it shows respect. People do think about that. You know, people think about how you respect brands. And, you know, there's a lot of changes need to go on. A lot of things need to happen. Mm. And, yes, I'm sure they'll talk to me. I'm sure we'll be working together. Yeah, we're... to just get the image up there. And now the book's out, the book, you know, that possibly could bring a bit more life. You get a few more people, get more people seeing the name, seeing the brand. So definitely. I'm full of optimism. We're going to see a new generation coming out now, and it's going to be very interesting.
Absolutely. Do you know what I mean? Do you still get a bit of a buzz when you're walking down the street and someone's got a pair of Reeboks on and you're going, yo, that's me, that is. They don't know that's me, but that's me right there. And what sort of emotions does that evoke within you?
Well, I always notice Reebok shoes, as you can imagine. Yeah. It's one of the handicaps of life these days. you're looking at footwear. It's like we talk about when we became number one, when we got there, when Aztec got that 5 stars, you know, what was my feeling at the time? It's hard to say now because we're running so fast.
Mm.
Things were happening best. Now I can step back and I can think, wow, did we really do that?
Yeah.
Did that really happen? Yeah, it's incredible. Would you do it now? Well, no, I'm too old now. I know too much now. I know the pitfalls are too many to go down and get up. It's like, you know, I am too old. You need to be young to be an entrepreneur. You know, when Jeff and I were 23, 25, we didn't even know the word existed. Mm. Entrepreneur, that's something new. We didn't know that. But yeah, when you get to a certain age and you do, I look back on it and I think, how did you manage to get on so many planes? You know, we had no mobile phone. I had no computers. If I was lucky, I had a calculator, if I was lucky, and a handful of American Express traveler's checks. You know,
yeah.
Traveler's checks. Whoa, flashback.
Wow. Yeah. I just flashback. About remember those.
That's it. No credit cards. You know, it's like,
yeah,
that's it. Traveler's checks. So,
yeah.
In fact, I remember arriving in from, I think I'd just come in from China, from Hong Kong, into America. And it was Hawaii at the time because you go in, I was going via Hawaii, and I got stopped by the guy there on immigration. And he walked away from me three times, sort of, and I'm wondering, what's going on here? Mm. And he'd asked me, how much money have we got? And it was like, oh, I've got these traveler's checks, you know. But what he was looking at is in my briefcase at that time, I had three copies of a running magazine that had been given to me by a guy called Andrea Brunier, who was our sailor, was our man in Hong Kong, and they were called China Runner. and these three, he'd had these three out. So it's, there's this connection with China. And it took them, I held up the queue for at least 30 minutes whilst this guy went backwards and forwards and took these books, came back. And when he came back, he didn't say anything. He said, okay, go. I've been there. What's going on here? I could expect him pulling me through to the back there and sending me somewhere for interrogation. China Runner, you know, you think, and this is, you know, this was traveling in those days. You know, it's just, I was just traveling. And I had to be traveling, but you get so many different stories. I mean, there are so many different stories that none in the book, but writing the book that I put so much in, but then people helped me and they said, you got to take that out. That's an anecdote. You got to take that out. That's an, so the story didn't get confused.
Yeah. Well, it must've been so hard to kind of pick what you were going to put in the book. And I mean, just, and to all the listeners, you've got to get a copy of Joe's book, Shoemaker. It's a real roller coaster ride. And, you know, we've heard a bit today, you know, about that whole journey that Jeff's been on. Joe and his brother, Jeff. And absolutely. I know Kish has got it. I've read it. It's a fantastic book.
Yeah, I bought it directly off Joe, and I put it on Instagram. He sent me a signed copy and all that. Do you know what I mean?
Brilliant.
So. We're following you're following me on Instagram. Do you know that?
Oh yes, I know that. We're following. I think we remember. I think Julie, who does our tech work, said, Kish, we signed a book for him. Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's pride of place. It's just exactly. It's not on that shelf.
No.
It's on that shelf over there
with
all the key ones. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like Jason's books over there as well. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's been amazing to talk to you, Joe. I think both Kish and I have had an absolute blast in just hearing some of those stories. You know, you've lived an incredible life, and you know, the legacy you've left in Reebok, which is literally on the feet of millions. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah,
it's been an absolute pleasure, Jason. It's and Kish, great, loved it. Yes. So anytime, keep in touch. Julie's here, and she'll answer the messages and make any other arrangements you want. But it's been great. Thank you very much.
Brilliant stuff.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Joe.
Thank you.
Oh, my days, Jace.
Wow.
I know that you know the subject at hand. And I've read excerpts of the book. I haven't fully, digested it, but I didn't want to say that to Joe. I haven't had a chance to, fully go in on the book because I want to have that time to just, like, sit down and marinate with it. But what a dude. What he achieved, absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, one of the true icons of the sneaker business. And, he's quite self-deprecating, which is almost quite refreshing in this business.
There's no airs and graces, was there?
Exactly.
Super regular.
Yeah. What he and his brother achieved, very few people, not just in the shoe business, but in industry in general, have ever achieved. And, to be that chilled and relaxed about it, just amazing. What a brilliant guy.
Absolute legend. Absolute legend. absolute legend. Yeah, you know I mean, Jason, big credit for you for sorting that one out, mate.
Nah, no worries. So, sadly, that's all we've got time for. Thanks for listening, everyone. Remember to send your comments and questions to us on Twitter or Instagram at soulful_podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you are enjoying the show, please do leave us a nice review. We really appreciate it.
We really would. And we've got to shout out Rachel and Dabby Day as always. This has been a Soho Radio Originals production. See you next time.